for the respondent, Steven Tsushima. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you ready to proceed? All right. It's my understanding, Mr. Ante, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that correct? And you'll get a warning light when that you're beginning to get to that 5 minutes of time during your argument. And then, Mr. Tsushima, you'll get a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. All right? Very well. Please proceed then. Thank you.
May it please the court. Deputy Public Defender Kersha Durant on behalf of petitioner, Mr. Jason Keyes. With the court's permission, as previously indicated, I am requesting that I be allowed to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
Your Honors, on January 29, 2009, Mr. Keyes had the right to use physical force to discipline his son. And the force that he employed was done in due regard of Julian's age and his size. He limited the amount of force that was used. He limited the number of spanks that were used. And the spanks were focused on an area of Julian's body that was covered with clothing, his buttocks. And his actions are protected under the law. In this case, the Intermediate Court of Appeal gravely erred in several ways. First, the ICA erred in holding that there was sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction in this case. Second, the Intermediate Court of Appeals erred in holding that the prosecutor did not engage in prosecutorial misconduct. Third, the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in making presumptions about evidence that was received during the trial in order to sustain the conviction. And lastly, the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in failing to address Mr. Keyes' request to stay the sentence in pending appeal. Focusing first on the ICA's error in finding that there was sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction. First, there was insufficient evidence to establish that Mr. Keyes had the requisite intent to harass, annoy, or alarm Julian in this case. The complainant, Julian, testified that his father hit him because he was misbehaving. That was clear from his understanding. Mr. Keyes testified that he spanked Julian because he had verbally disciplined him previously, and that was on January 27, 2009, he had verbally disciplined him already, and then the behavior had escalated. And he had also warned Julian at that time on January 27th that if the behavior did continue, he would be getting spankings from his father. So it was clear to Julian that the reason why he was spanked on January 28, 2009 was because he was disciplining him for the escalation in behavior. Additionally, Mr. Keyes himself testified at the trial that his intent when he did spank Julian was to discipline him. So the only evidence that was elicited in this trial supports a finding that his intent was to discipline Julian. His intent was not to harass, not to annoy, and not to alarm Julian. And therefore, the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in failing to find that there was insufficient evidence to establish the requisite state of mind for harassment. But additionally, and probably more importantly, the Intermediate Court of Appeals gravely erred in failing to find that Mr. Keyes' conduct was justified under the parental discipline defense statute. The elements for parental discipline, for an individual to assert the parental discipline defense and which the state must disprove in a trial, are that first, the individual is a parent or guardian, and I think that was undisputed in the trial. Additionally, that the force is used against the minor for whom the defendant has to care for. And in this case, again, this is the biological father of Julian. It's undisputed that this is a minor that he cared for. Julian lived with him at the home with Julian's mother. Third, that the force used must be done with due regard to the minor's age and size. This was clearly the area of contention in the trial, and I will address that momentarily. But lastly, that the final prong for the parental discipline defense is that the force must be reasonably related to safeguarding, promoting the minor's welfare, including the prevention of misconduct or punishment. And in this case, again, the fourth prong, it's clear from the record or the evidence in trial that that was also not disputed. The state conceded that the force used was done for the purposes of disciplining Julian. So the issue at the trial was very narrowly focused on whether the force was used with due regard to the minor's age and size. And there is something very significant that I want to point out from the Intermediate Court of Appeals memorandum opinion, which is that they did look at the size of Mr. Kesey, that was referenced in the memorandum opinion. And I think they noted him as being, they gave his height and his weight, but that, we're asking that the court strike that from the record. First, that was not included in the evidence, or that was not elicited in the trial. In this case, I did review the transcript. There was no questioning as to my client's height or his size. That information was obtained from documents that were inappropriately attached in the record on appeal, and therefore that cannot be evidence that the ICA should have considered in rendering their opinion, but also that is not evidence that is before this court in deciding the case at this point.
But putting aside that, counsel, though, didn't the trial court have the opportunity to observe the defendant and the child in person?
That is correct, Your Honor, and I think that's reflected in the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law. But even with the court giving consideration to the size of an individual and their child, I think it would lead to absurd results if there was a finding or a holding that a parent that is larger than a child is not able to discipline. This case, the facts of this particular case, which involved an 8-year-old child, approximately 4 feet tall, and although there was no actual evidence elicited about his specific weight, he was observed by the court to be of thin build. This case is similar to State versus Robertson, where the Intermediate Court of Appeals found that it was an appropriate use of parental discipline when the defendant in that case used a belt to spank his son 10 to 15 times, 8 times which made contact. That was spankings to a bare bottom, and though that spanking resulted in bruising which lasted for several days. Now granted, the minor in that case was older than the minor in this case. However, the height of that minor was 4 feet, and this is the minor in Robertson. The weight of that minor was 50 pounds. So in that sense, there's a factual similarity between this instance case and that of Robertson. And Robertson was an Intermediate Court of Appeals case, I understand that, but it has not been overturned.
Not to interrupt you, Counsel, but isn't the child in this case 6 rather than 8, as
I
you mentioned?
Sure. Yes, he's
and then in the defendant's weight was 140 pounds, so it wasn't like it was an overwhelming difference in, say, a 300-pound adult. So I don't, are you saying that was a significant factor in the conviction?
I'm sorry, significant factor?
Are you saying that the disparity in the size of the minor child, age 6, and the 140-pound defendant was a significant factor in the conviction?
I think when the court reviews the findings of facts in this case, that it does appear that one of the factors that Judge Liu considered was the small size of the minor, and that because of the small size of the minor, 6 years old and being of thin build, that he did determine that the force, that Judge Liu did determine that the force used was not employed with due regard to his age and size. And so my position is just that if that is the case, all parents are larger than their children. So just looking at the size, the comparative size of a parent to a child, the analysis should not stop there. It needs to go beyond that. And I thank the court for correcting me. It was in Robertson where the minor child was 8 years old, and in this case, 6 years old. But the size of the individuals, because that is a factor under the parental discipline defense, the size of the minor, I think, is of consideration that this court and that the trial courts need to apply in determining when parental discipline is appropriate or when that defense is appropriately raised. But in this particular case, the trial court and the ICA both erred in finding that simply because the minor may have been 6 years old or simply because the minor was only 4 feet tall and of a thin build, that therefore the parental discipline defense was not appropriately used.
Didn't the ICA also consider the means of the discipline, the use of a stick with, I guess, sufficient force to leave welts that were noticeable the next day?
Yes, Your Honor. That was a consideration as well. Again, I think it's clear from State versus Montevalle that the use of any type of instrument to discipline a child is not something that's going to automatically preclude the use of parental discipline. And in this case, it was referred to as a stick, but the force was used and directed in the buttocks area. And I think that that was, well, that was also an incorrect limitation that the trial court and the ICA put on the facts in this case, that they simply stopped the analysis because an instrument was used to discipline is also inappropriate. That is a factor, but I think, well, when the court views the other evidence in this case, which indicated that the injuries were red marks to his arms, and that was because the minor was trying to prevent the punishment from happening, and a red mark to his face, that type of injury is also much less severe than that of Robertson, than that of many other cases in the litany of parental discipline cases that have come before this court and the ICA. And in addition, in State versus Montevale, the language is clear that even where there's an isolated instance of bruising, that is not something that precludes the use, that is not something that renders the parental discipline, the use of force for parental discipline inappropriate.
Although Montevale is a much older child, correct? 14.
That is 14. Correct. So that is correct.
Is that a legitimate consideration? I guess looking at the age of the child in relation to the nature of the discipline being imposed?
I think that is obviously something that the court must consider, and that's clear from the language of State versus Montevale, because it's a case-by-case basis for the court to make a determination. But in this case, and the type of force that was used, that this was not an incident where there was excessive force used. This was a slap to the face, which Mr. Keyes testified was done because the minor had lied about getting into trouble again that day. The slap to the face, Mr. Keyes testified that it was not hard because he is much smaller than him, and that's his son that he loves.
And then it was visible the next day.
The mark to the face, there was testimony that there was a mark observed on Julian's face.
Wasn't there a photo of that also?
I believe there was a photo that was admitted into evidence. But the marks, again, in many other cases that have come before this court and the ICA, there have been visible marks left on the minors up to 8 days, 6 days. In Robertson, the minor, it was only after 8 days when he went to the doctor.
Robertson was a memorandum opinion, was it not?
Yes, it
not
was.
Not binding.
It was a memorandum opinion, but it was never overruled by this court. And under HRAP 35, I think it can be cited and used as guidance for the trial courts, and it has been used as guidance in arguing before the trial courts in parental discipline type cases. So at this point, that is something that when I review the parental discipline history or the case law that has come already, a lot of the minors are older, and in that sense, it's factually dissimilar. But Robertson is a case where the minor is relatively close in age, relatively close in size, and that is, at this point, good case law as far as whether or not the parental discipline defense is appropriate in those types of situations.
Not for precedential value, though. Let's make it clear. It's usually when you say good case law, that's for precedential value, and specifically memorandum opinions are not allowed to be cited for precedential value.
And I guess with HREP Rule 35, if I can clarify, that it is used and cited under HREP 35 as persuasive value to the court, yes. And to that extent, I guess in my experience before the trial court, that case law has been considered when offered for its persuasive value has been deemed persuasive. But aside from that, in the case-by-case analysis, which is required under Montevale and the parental discipline statute, the analysis of the facts in this case indicate that the force was not excessive, that the force was reasonable, it was clearly related to parental discipline. While there were red marks, this was not a case where there was bruising for an extended period of time. This is not a case where the minor was unable to carry on with his daily activities. He went to school the next day. And that's also significant as well. I think the fact that the parents in this case, or Mr. Keyes in this case, disciplined the minor and then the minor was sent to school also indicates or suggests that the force used was not done with an intent to be excessive. It was done with the intent of disciplining the minor to help with shaping the minor, his character, and who he was going to be in the future. And there was also a graduation. This was not a case where Mr. Keyes automatically used force, physical force to discipline. On the first day, when it was brought to his attention that Julian had been misbehaving, he talked to Julian. That was on January 27th. They sat down, they talked. He took away the Xbox. He took away other privileges that Julian was entitled to. That did not work. And because that did not work, and because Julian's behavior escalated the next day, escalated to the point that it was not only the teacher reporting that he had engaged in misconduct, but it was a cafeteria manager who felt that if his conduct, Julian's conduct, had risen to the level where it was important enough to bring it to the teacher's attention and ask the teacher to notify the parents because he was spitting and wrestling with children in the cafeteria.
I guess if the child misbehaved 3 days in a row and lied to his father, then I would think a reasonable person would not come to the conclusion that some discipline was necessary for the welfare of the child. So in this case, well, who decides whether the discipline was with due regard to the age and the size of the child?
If I understand the question correctly, Your Honor, I think it's the parent's ultimate duty to determine.
Who legally decides whether the discipline was appropriate?
Then it would be the court in applying the parental discipline, I guess the trier of fact, applying the facts and the relevant law. But
anything in this record that would skew the ultimate decision of the court that the discipline was inappropriate for the age and size of the minor?
There was no medical evidence in this case to indicate that the injuries suffered were so severe as to preclude the use of the parental discipline defense. And I think, well, when looking at the intent with the amendment of the parental discipline defense and also the case law that has come since then, that it's clear that even though the use of force to discipline children may not be something socially acceptable, that is something that under allowable statutes and the boundaries of the law.
In speaking in terms of burdens and duties and allocation of who decides what, is there anything in this record which would indicate that the court's ultimate decision was skewed for some reason?
Well, I think that the court failed to find that the state did not disprove parental discipline was appropriate in this case. The court in this case, it appeared to say that it just focused on this one factor, and that was the factor of the force that was employed, and that it was not done with due regard to his age and size. But the consideration of those factors and whether or not it's raised by the defense, it's still the state's duty to disprove that. And I think that the fact that there was significant evidence, it was undisputed this was for parental discipline, that even though there may have been some type of indication that it may have been excessive under the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that the state failed to disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt that this was parental discipline. So that is another way that the trial court erred in this case.
Did the defendant indicate in his testimony that or acknowledge that had he simply spanked the child with his hand, that would have been sufficient as opposed to using a stick? Was there testimony to that effect, and what would you make of that testimony?
I think, if I recall from my review of the transcript, that was in response to a question from the prosecutor. It was on cross-examination, and his statement was that he had spanked before. I think it's not clear because they do have two children. Spanked before, and that has been effective in the past. But that statement in and of itself does not preclude the use of the force or the type of force that was used in this particular case, because for various reasons. First, he did, as I indicated, it was a graduated or as an escalation of misbehavior in this case. He misbehaved, talking was used, non-physical form of disciplines were used, and that was not effective. And it was at that point that physical force was used. And a physical spanking, while it was speculation, first of all, for him to acknowledge that it may have been effective. But regardless, the parental discipline defense protects the decisions of a parent to discipline a minor in the way that they deem is appropriate for that particular situation. And in this particular situation, because of the graduation in misbehavior, because of the fact that not only did the behavior escalate, but the minor lied on the date of this particular incident, it was reasonable for him to use force other than just with his hand. And again, it's really significant in this case that the focus of where the force was, the focus was directed at his buttocks. This is not a case like other parental discipline cases that have come before this court. This is not a case where the parent was trying to hit the minor in the face, where there might be a risk of some type of serious injury. This is not a case where there was any type of excessive force used. This was a case where a parent used essentially a stick to spank their child on the bottom for a limited amount of time, 5 to 6 times. This is not like Robertson, where the father instructed the son to pull down his pants to expose his bare buttocks to be spanked with the belt. He was exercising due regard for his age and size by focusing the force in an area that would make the point, but would not be excessive. And unfortunately, the minor did try to prevent that, and then there were marks on his arms. But again, under Matavale, the fact that there are marks or bruising, again, would not preclude or would not render parental discipline inappropriate in this case. And that still is a hurdle that the state would have to overcome in disproving that parental discipline was appropriate.
So you're arguing that it should be up to the parent to decide what form of physical discipline to use?
That is a yes, Your Honor.
So this was a futon stick, 18 to 24 inches long is what the trial judge found. This is a stick used, you know, to hang the futon and beat the futon. Would beating the way a person would beat a futon, would that be reasonable?
Well, had that evidence been elicited in this case, that would be something that the court could consider.
Isn't it for the fact finder to determine what level of force was used?
And that is one of the reasons why, in this case, the trial court erred. Because the trial court just simply said because he was small.
Couldn't the fact finder rely on circumstantial evidence and all of the evidence, as well as the welts that were left, to try to determine what level of force was used?
Well, there was no evidence that, aside from the marks which, as observed in the photos, there were red marks. Aside from that, there was no other evidence, I think, for the court to draw any inferences about the use of force. The prosecutor failed to elicit that type of information.
As in Stalker, couldn't the trial court have considered defendant's admission, own testimony, that he started off with a slap to the face, which actually left a mark the next day? Wouldn't that be the totality of the evidence that might suggest a level of force that was actually used with a stick?
Yes, it is ultimately the court's, the fact finder's duty to make a finding about the type level of force used. But the manner in which, I'm assuming the court is alluding to the fact that there was a smack prior to the use of a stick, and that could show his level of intent or his state of mind, his emotional state at that point. With State versus Matavale, that's also addressed in that case, that even when parents discipline out of frustration or anger, that in real life situations, it is likely that a parent would be frustrated or angry at the time of discipline, but that does not preclude the use of parental discipline as so long as the force is tempered. And there is insufficient evidence in the trial record to establish the level of force that was used. All that's really left in the trial record is that Mr. Keyes admitted that he used a stick. As far as the force used, the only evidence, based on my review, was when the defense counsel asked about the slap and did he stumble back, did Julian stumble back at the slap? That did not happen. That was really the only question about the use of force used. Now, to draw an inference about the injuries and the injuries giving an indication of the amount of force used, first of all, The injuries in this case were red marks. There's no indication that the red marks lasted for several days. Again, he went to school the next day, so it was not so significant that it inhibited his ability to do his daily functions. But also, when looking at his intent and where he was trying to focus the force, there may have been red marks on his arms, but had the spankings landed in the area where it was intended, had they not been blocked by the minor, that would have landed on his buttocks. So there may have been red welts on his, or sorry, red marks on his arm, indicating some type of force. But I think, again, it's not just looking at where the injuries happened, but also his intent and the totality of the circumstances, that in this case, even though there were red marks, his intent was to spank his buttocks, or it would have been fully clothed, where the any type of injury would have been muted, I guess, by the presence of clothing. But I do see that my initial time is up, Your Honors. We are asking that the court reverse the conviction in this case because there's insufficient evidence to sustain the conviction.
Thank you very much. Mr. Tsushima, your argument?
May it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima on behalf of the State of Hawaii. As noted by opposing counsel, defendant appellant presents four questions to this court. I'd like to start with what I believe may be the question of the day, the sufficiency of the evidence questions. Starting with the sufficiency of the evidence with regard to the harassment offense itself, it appears both parties agree that Stalker provides guidance in this case, but disagree with regard to its application and the reasonable inferences which may be drawn for the evidence adduced in the case. Both parties agree that the state of mind of an individual may be read from his or her acts, conduct, and inferences fairly drawn from all circumstances based on Stalker. Both parties further agree that in Stalker, this court found that the family court in that case could reasonably have inferred that defendant slapping his son in the face and then his conduct to annoy or alarm his son. The defendant here argues that based upon the reasonable inferences drawn, his only intent was to punish Julian for lying and for his misbehavior in the cafeteria. The defendant further argues that the ICA's analysis that defendant hit Julian with a stick and his open hand does not lead to any inference that he hit Julian with the requisite mens rea. Defendant argues in his application for cert that although he was mad and disappointed that Julian had lied and misbehaved, unlike the situation in Starker, there's no evidence that Keese was angry, yelling, or struck out with intent to harass, annoy, or alarm. However, like the defendant's doctor, defendant acknowledges he got mad at Julian. Defendant's argument appears to rely on a distinction between being mad and being angry and yelling, to which the state finds none. In this case, with regard to the harassment offense, there's multiple intents shown. While defendant characterizes his intent as discipline, there's also the intent to annoy or alarm, which can accompany such intent. I'd like to turn to the parental justification defense, which this court has discussed in detail with co-counsel. And I think we're both in agreement on the standards.
Excuse me, Mr. Tsushima.
Yes.
I guess what troubles me in this case is marginal fairness of this trial. And I don't know, did you read through the transcript?
Yes.
The prosecution continually asked the complainant, do you remember telling me that you said this? No. Do you see anything improper about that?
Yes.
What is that?
Well, amongst other things, one of the things is what defendant did argue in their brief. It's bringing the hearsay out as a court statement, but it's also making the attorney part of the, as a testifier by wording the question in that manner.
Yeah, in this sense, the lawyer is reading into the record evidence and is not subject to cross-examination. Mm-hmm. Yet it's done over and over and over again, and the court sustains or overrules objection to that question over and over and over again. Do you think the defendant in this case got a fair trial?
Yes, I do.
Why, in light of that?
If this would have been in front of a jury, I think I'd be hard-pressed to say he got a fair trial, because at that point, you have a bunch of jurors who don't know what to do with this evidence. But in this case, there's a presumption that the court's going to disregard this incompetent evidence.
It's a helpful presumption to judges and to appellate courts. But my question is, how can, I assume that presumption is rebuttable, right?
Well, yes.
So wouldn't that presumption be rebuttable if the court, by its rulings, indicates that it has an erroneous view of what the law is, by continuing to overrule objections to what clearly are improper questions?
No, I don't think that would rebuttable.
You don't think in that situation we can say the presumption should not apply?
I think in that case, the court was just moving the matter along. I think he saw that the prosecutor was going to continue.
The court didn't understand the law, you're saying?
No, I think the court did understand the law.
And why did it overrule the objection?
Just to move matters along. He saw that the prosecutor was going to ask this question, he was going to get this answer, he was going to ask it multiple ways.
Actually, sustaining the objection would shorten the trial. I'm so sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Assuming this is prosecutorial misconduct, how is it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
It's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because we are dealing in a bench trial where the court can disregard the questions that were being asked or any incompetent evidence. And the record supports that because the court makes no reference to any of the evidence that was seemingly being brought in or attempted to be brought in. So we totally admit that these questions were error, but it's not reversible error under the circumstances. Again, I do concede.
The prosecutor also says that, well, this isn't hearsay. It's to bring out a consistent statement. Is that correct?
Consistent.
Is that correct under the rules of evidence? That the reason for eliciting these answers are that it's a consistent statement.
I don't think under these circumstances it would have been particularly.
You agree that's incorrect?
Correct.
That use of the rule of evidence concerning consistent statements.
Correct.
So that would be another thing to add to whether or not this was a trial that was tried on the law and on, correctly trialed, tried on the law and on the evidence.
Whether it would be a factor to be considered, whether a defendant got a fair trial?
Yes.
Yeah, sure. Now, what it seems here is that parties do agree on the standards, and that's whether, in this case where we're looking at the parental justification defense, we're looking at whether the state has elicited sufficient evidence to prove beyond reasonable doubt.
Mr. Shima, if I could come back to that, is there anything in the record to indicate that the court put substantive weight on any of these prior statements? Or
is there anything in the record to show that it did put substantive
weight? Yes.
No. The record seems to show that the court did, in fact, disregard it. The court made no reference to any of these statements that are being complained of or the questions relating to those.
Were any of the objections related to the fact that the prosecutor might have been improperly testifying about matters that occurred outside the courtroom?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Were there any objections along the lines of what are being asked here today, that it was improper for the prosecutor to talk about conversations he had with the witness outside the courtroom? Was that the basis of any of the objections as opposed to hearsay or some other basis?
No. I don't think they used prosecutorial misconduct as the basis for the objection. I think it was just improper. It was more of a general. If I remember right, the objection that was used at the trial level.
Were on other bases?
Were on other bases and was not on for prosecutorial misconduct.
Of course, we would have to assume that since the court overruled the objection, it allowed whatever the prosecutor said into the record and into the evidence and allowed the answers, the responses of the witness, which should have been stricken, you would think, with respect to those questions.
To consider substantively?
Yes,
I don't think so.
Because those questions elicited, well, the witness nodded or shook.
No, I don't think we have evidence that the court considered.
Well, we don't have evidence it didn't, right? Because the objection was overruled, so the matter was allowed.
We do in that the court's specific findings with regard to, and I believe what we're getting at is the question.
I don't have the specific findings in front of me, but I did read them. And I recall the court just made statements. Mm-hmm. It didn't attribute it to any particular witness or any particular testimony. Recall that? It just flat out said whatever it needed to in order to meet the elements.
That's correct. And I believe the question that we're talking about is the question relating to whether or not Julian had remembered if, speaking outside the courtroom, he had mentioned that he was hit in the face with a stick. I believe that's the complaint of question that we're talking about. And when I say look at the findings of fact, and that's not specifically mentioned there, although you're correct, Justice Scobie, but the court didn't mention which specific testimony it got a specific striking or discipline from. There is no mention of Julian getting hit in the face with a stick. And that's the question.
There isn't, because there is no evidence that he was struck in the face with a stick.
And that's what I'm trying to say, is evidence that the court disregarded it as incompetent evidence.
Well, I don't know if the court disregarded it, but in his argument, final argument to the court, the prosecutor said, we don't have evidence of that. In effect, said, we don't have evidence of the child being struck in the face with a stick.
In that the court disregarded it, yes.
No.
Yeah.
Well, actually, oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Didn't Officer Cullen testify that when he asked, he met with Julian, and he asked how he got the red marks? And as to red marks, he had been talking about red marks across his arm, his hand, and across his face. Officer Cullen did say that he stated to me that Daddy spanked him with a yellow stick.
Yes, that is in the record. Okay. I don't believe that was brought in for the truth of the matter asserted. I don't think it, or was argued.
There was no
way.
Objection to that question.
And there is no objection to that question.
There was a hearsay objection.
Oh, there was a hearsay.
And it was overruled.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay, the next day.
Mr. Shishima, in your brief, you concede that the court erred in not staying the sentence. And in so doing, you rely on 804-4, is that correct?
Correct.
And that's a bail statute, isn't it?
Right.
Was Mr. Keyes sentenced as jail? Wasn't he just sentenced to...
No, he was not. No, he was just kind of classic.
So does the statute then apply if he wasn't sentenced to jail?
That was still my understanding of the statute. I'll admit it's possible I misread the statute. But my understanding, I guess, in not considering whether imprisonment was part of what the defendant has a right in the posting bail. Our statute, but I guess I may have read that statute broadly.
Well, also, doesn't 804 also say that, except as provided in 641-14A, and that allows for the court to have discretion, doesn't it? So how would you read those two statutes in conjunction with one another, even if bail were imposed?
I don't have the statute in front of me, I apologize. But I thought that the part where the court had discretion wasn't as to the petty misdemeanor. I could be wrong. I apologize that I don't have the statute in front of me.
Doesn't 804-4B say that no defendant entitled to bail shall be subject to the operation of any sentence passed upon the defendant?
Yeah, that is my understanding, yes.
So would that not have entitled the defendant to a stay of the operation of the sentence of probation?
That's what I thought. That was my understanding of reading the statute. Which is why I believe in that one, on the brief, we did concur. But admittedly, I had not considered what Justice Nathan had just pointed out.
About 641.14?
Correct. I apologize that I don't have that statute in front of me. But in any event, in regard to that particular issue, defendant's conviction would not be reversible on the strength of that issue alone. So even if this court does decide to address that issue and find that defendant should have been granted his stay pending appeal, that would not justify a reversal of the conviction in this case. Counsel was here in discussing some of the factors that the state had pointed out in its brief, which went to the court's consideration of whether there is due regard in this case to the age and size of the of Julian in administering the discipline. The state would want to point out that no single factor, of course, precludes the justification defense, but this is just some of the factors that the court should take under consideration. And I believe both parties are in agreement that one of the things the court does have to look at is all the circumstances of the case. And then in this case, that's relevant to a determination of whether the force used in this case was reasonable or moderate. In this case, this would be the first time the court is reviewing a case where the minor is so young. This would be the youngest case at 6-year-old. And there's a mention of him being 4 feet. What we do have is under 4 feet, unknown weight. But without debating at it, the court can look at the photos of Julian under Exhibits 2, 3, and 4, as well as defendant's own description of Julian as pretty small.
Mr. Tsushima, are you aware of any other cases, either 6 or 7 year olds being involved?
Parental discipline cases?
Yes.
As far as opinions, either published or unpublished?
Yes.
I'm aware of one other unpublished decision.
What is that?
That would be Tyler in 2007.
What's the name of the case?
Tyler. I believe it's General's Tyler. The last name is spelled T-A-I-L-O. That was an unpublished ICA 2007 case.
Who was the holding in that case?
That was an abuse case. It was reversed on another matter, however. In that case, I believe it was a 6-year-old daughter who hit her school note on this that was with regard to misbehavior. The court found that there was sufficient evidence in that case based on the child's age, the child's stature, and the natures inflicted that the court could not see as a matter of law when viewed in light most favorable to the state, there's insufficient evidence to disprove defendant's parental justification defense. In that case, the child, the 6-year-old daughter, was hit with a back scratcher many times, so hard it broke. In that case, they had a health aide who testified that was the worst bruising she had seen in 20 years. There was a bump on the head, bruise on the arm, extensive bruising on the body, left shoulder blade, down the back, and on the buttocks. So admittedly, there were a lot more visibles in that case.
Thank you.
As far as this court, however, this would be the first time the Supreme Court has seen a case of this size, this age. And what we have, again, we all agree the kid was small. We have the finding of fact 16, although challenged, it said based on the fact finder's own visual observations, Julian was a thin, slight boy and much smaller in comparison to the defendant. What we need to do is we need to look at the age and size, and we need to look at, as well, the misbehavior or the misconduct. And in this case, the misbehavior was described by Ayako as too playful in the cafeteria. I think there's reference to spitting food, as well as blaming classmates for making him do these things. In this case, we're not dealing with poor grades. We're not talking about skipping classes. We're not talking about a kid who was punching the parent. We're looking at some playful misbehavior, which defendant has characterized as being dangerous, but there's actual testimony by Yako that it was not dangerous. In this case, with regard to the playful misbehavior that occurred in school, defendant had slapped Julian into the face with such force that you could see a visible on the cheek, which I believe is, forget which exhibit it was in, but one of two, three, or four shows a close-up of his face. He was struck with a bamboo stick with such force that visible welts were shown, and at least five strikes were administered upon Julian. What that evidence shows, and with regard to the court's finding of with whether the force was used with due regard for the agent's size of the child, is it shows a reasonable inference of a high degree of pain that was not reasonable or moderate given the misconduct in this case, which again was just playfulness in the cafeteria by a six-year-old. And the finding of fact that I, or the facts that I just stated was under finding of fact number 12, which was not challenged by defendant, and therefore binding upon this court, and that's taking reasonable inferences from the evidence presented, including the photos. The trial court found that Julian was struck over five times by the defendant with the futon stick with enough force to leave very visible welts next morning. And again, this court does have exhibits 2, 3, and 4 before it to see for itself whether those welts were in fact very visible. And again, these findings were not challenged. The other thing this, the state would like to point out is when we're reviewing this, we're reviewing it in the light most favorable to the state. A couple of times while we're talking about the evidence, we have made mention to defendant's testimony. Such testimony as, I wasn't hitting him that hard because he's just a kid, with regard to the slap to the face. Now, I think we agree that it was within the court's realm to not believe defendant and to find that defendant was not credible based on the visible injury to Julian's cheek that was clearly visible in the picture submitted into evidence. Now, admittedly, these injuries do not preclude an explanation or consideration of the reasonableness of the force, but the state would submit that the court did have substantial evidence before it to determine that it was not reasonable or moderate given the mild misbehavior. What we're supposed to look at is the totality of the circumstances. And in this case, it was within the court's realm to find that it was not moderate or reasonable and not reasonably proportionate to Julian's misbehavior and not reasonably believed necessary to discipline Julian. In this case, we have finding of fact 14, which was, again, was not challenged by defendant binding upon this court. And that was that no physical force was used against Julian for the 3 days prior for this misconduct. Finding of fact 15, which was not challenged by defendant, which was prior physical force used by defender Ayako was usually limited to the use of bare hands, which resulted in Julian correcting his behavior. In addition, there was testimony by Ayako that she planned on discussing Julian's behavior in the cafeteria together with defendant. Ayako told Julian, when they get home, they'll be talking about this together, so that they would just talk. There's no testimony from any other witness other than defendant that Julian was told that he would be spanked if he misbehaved again. And again, that goes to credibility, and that would be the weight of the evidence for the trial court to determine. The court could have, and was within its right to disregard that testimony and find that the defendant was not believable. The court was in the best position to see the defendant while he testified, look him in the eye and say, no, I don't believe you. So when this court is reviewing the evidence, the state would point out that it is to be reviewed in the light most favorable to the state, and that credibility issues were left for the trial court to determine. In addition, the other thing defendant had mentioned is that he himself had admitted that a hand spank on Julian's bottom would have been effective in this case. What that turns to is the state's ultimate conclusion, and that's based on the particular circumstances of this case, it should not be said as a matter of law that when viewed in the light most favorable to the state, there's insufficient evidence to disprove defendant's parental justification defense. Under the circumstances of this case and taking the reasonable inferences from the evidence presented, as well as finding fact 12, which I just stated, which showed that Julian was struck 5 times with a futon stick with enough force to leave very visible welts, considering the totality of the circumstances, there was substantial evidence from which the trial fact could conclude the force employed by the defendant, that is, the degree of force and the utilization of the bamboo stick, was not moderate or reasonable. And if the court doesn't have any further questions, that's all I have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Ant, your rebuttal.
Just briefly, Your Honors. The fact that Mr. Kisei testified that spanking with a hand had been effective in the past does not preclude him from exercising his discretion as the parent in this case and determining that a different method of discipline was appropriate and necessary. That still does not eliminate the need for the court to assess whether or not the method of force he did use in this case was reasonable. And it was reasonable in this case, as articulated earlier. With respect to the testimony or the suggestion that because the misconduct was not dangerous, that it was merely playful, that meant it was not reasonable, the punishment or the discipline used was not reasonable. First and foremost, he was being disciplined for lying. He was also being disciplined for misbehaving. Whether or not that misbehaving involved being dangerous or playing with others dangerously is irrelevant. His father had told him that he had confronted him about misbehaving. He had told him if he continued to misbehave, he would be punished. He was being punished for disobeying his father. But there is, I'm sorry.
Mr. Rent, why does the statute concerning when 804-4 apply in this case?
It applies, Your Honor, because, first of all, by, I believe, this plain reading of the statute, an individual that is convicted of a petty misdemeanor offense is entitled to bail as a matter of right, which along with that includes the stay of any other type of sentence, including probation and parenting classes.
Doesn't the sentence start, no defendant entitled to bail? And was he entitled to bail in this case? He wasn't. Didn't receive a imprisonment sentence, did he?
I think the question is that given the fact that the statute indicates that all individuals who are convicted of a petty misdemeanor are entitled to bail as a matter of right, that the indication is in that situation that the court or the legislature deemed it appropriate that individuals convicted of petty misdemeanors should not have to suffer the punishments imposed pending the resolution of an appeal.
And wouldn't they have said that, though? Wouldn't they have said, instead of saying no defendant entitled to bail and putting it in the bail statute, wouldn't they have just said that no defendant convicted of a petty misdemeanor shall be subject to any sentence passed upon the defendant?
Your Honor, I don't have the 804 right in front of me right now, but it's my understanding that that is the indication in that statute. I may be incorrect, and I know that there's also case law that discusses 804, with specifically its application in petty misdemeanor cases, and that is something that we've argued many times before the trial courts.
What about, well, we're here now, and what is the difference, what is the, what is the import of the phrase, except as provided in 641-14A, which allows the court to have discretion?
And Your Honor, I apologize, I don't have HRS 614 before me.
Okay.
And now, but I do know that the bail statute also discusses not just convictions for petty misdemeanor, but also felony and other types of offenses. And I'm not sure if that may be referring to the discretion a court can exercise in those circumstances. But I think there's also policy reasons why an individual should be entitled to bail or a stay, I should say, of a sentence pending appeal when the conviction is for a petty misdemeanor offense. because of the fact that just given the natural judicial process, that that can take a while. And if there is an appeal, then we're obviously raising an issue that we believe is an appropriate issue that resulted in an incorrect conviction. And that given those circumstances, that public policy would also support staying a sentence which would likely end before the resolution of appeal.
I totally see that insofar as a jailable, an offense for which jail is a sentence. Anger management, family counseling. Do you think public policy should dictate that that sort of counseling should wait until after an appeal?
Well, two things. One, requiring the defendant, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I see my time is up.
You can finish your question, or finish your response to the question.
Requiring the defendant to undergo anger management while a case is pending an appeal, where we believe that there's a legitimate issue, I think, is counter to what our position would be, which is that if we believe that there was an incorrect conviction in that case, then therefore any resulting punishment or counseling even would be inappropriate. But in addition to that, Your Honor, in family court cases, the defendants are usually referred to the Family Peace Center for classes, and the amount, the financial burden to the individuals for paying for those classes is significant. It usually involves 24 weeks of classes, which is a sliding scale range, but it usually can be up to about $900, even for indigent clients. And they would have to go through that first before undergoing parenting, which is what I believe was ordered in this case. So while I understand that there may be a good basis to require, or a reason to require, an individual to undergo counseling, I think in light of the fact that this is a petty misdemeanor, in light of what we would be arguing in an appeal, that it would be inappropriate to require it at that time, that public policy still weighs in favor of staying the sentence pending appeal. And for those reasons, we're again renewing our request, asking the court to reverse the conviction.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The court will take this matter under advisement.